Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're starting the show today by talking about gastrointestinal health with our guest, Dr. Simona Saha. Joining us today, she's a gastroenterologist at UW Health, specializes in inflammatory bowel diseases and issues, GI issues related to pregnancy as well, and a professor in the Department of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. So as we talk with Dr. Saha, I hope you'll join in. Are you struggling with a GI disease, wondering what might help ease your pain? Maybe you have a success story to tell us, too. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Dr. Simona Saha, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for having me.
So what are the most common digestive problems patients come to you with?
Well, so amongst the constellation of GI conditions that we see in practice, there are, the range is pretty broad, spanning from things, related to the upper gastrointestinal tract. That would be like esophageal reflux disease. We also see stomach issues like gastritis or dyspepsia. We see intestinal issues related to conditions like Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. And we can also see other conditions like irritable bowel syndrome, constipation, hemorrhoidal disease. So really, we think about the GI tract as being everything from mouth to anus. And as gastroenterologists, we treat the whole tract from start to finish.
From one end to the other.
Right, from one end to the other, exactly.
Well, I know you have a specialty in inflammatory bowel diseases. What is inflammatory bowel disease and what are the symptoms?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the inflammatory bowel diseases are chronic GI tract diseases. They are characterized by a relapsing and remitting course, meaning there are periods of time when patients are doing quite well and their symptoms are in remission, and then there are periods of time when their disease is really active, and we call that in a flare state. There are two main subtypes of inflammatory bowel disease: Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. And the two have a lot of overlapping symptoms, but there are also things that make them distinct. And as gastroenterologists, that's our job, is to try to tease out which form of IBD a patient may have. But the overlapping symptoms to be aware of are abdominal pain, diarrhea, weight loss, fatigue, and in many cases, rectal bleeding. And the two diseases can be further differentiated based on where it's located and some of the other complications that we see, but that's kind of...
Yeah, and I imagine the treatments would be different depending on...
Yeah, the treatments, well, there are some treatments that work for both conditions, but then, yes, there are other approaches, the surgical approaches in particular, that are really going to be unique to whichever condition that the patient has.
We have a lot, every one of our lines is filled, which I expected, to be perfectly honest, and you might have as well. Marlene in Green Lake has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Marlene.
Hi. I've had Crohn's since I was 17, and I had a ton of abdominal surgeries, first one being an ileostomy. So I've had that since I was 17, and so I only have a third of my intestine. So I'm 65 now, and I'm basically suffering from lack of calcium absorption. And so I am really struggling with a lot of abdominal cramping at this point in my life. So I have cramps everywhere from all the adhesions, all the abdominal surgeries I have. So I can hardly do any physical activity. So I'm down to basically swimming, and that's all I can do. And that's just, not swimming per se, just doing, water exercises.
Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions for these abdominal cramping I'm having? And they are like full body cramps, and it doesn't matter how much water I drink.
Oh, I'm sorry for your condition, Marlene. Dr. Saha, what do you think?
Yeah, Marlene, you know, I'm also sorry to hear you've had such a rough course with your Crohn's disease. And it sounds like you were diagnosed almost 40 years ago. For patients who are more newly diagnosed, the good news is we have a lot of therapies available now that, unfortunately, probably Marlene, you weren't offered at that period of time, and that when you were first diagnosed, where our treatment options were much more limited. You probably saw a lot of steroids and maybe a medication like sulfasalazine before you had your surgery. At any rate, it sounds like what you're experiencing now are some complications related to maybe short bowel syndrome, since you lost so much intestine as part of your Crohn's journey. And like you mentioned, some of those, that abdominal pain and cramping might be related to adhesions. I guess I would want to also make sure that you don't have evidence of active disease in your small intestine. Although you lost your large intestine, which is probably where the bulk of your disease was, Crohn's disease is a disease that can involve the small intestine. And so one of the main things is to making sure there isn't active disease in other parts of your intestine that we may not be treating. Let's assume we don't see signs of active Crohn's disease, and we would figure that out using blood tests, stool testing, and maybe imaging, and possibly even a scope through the small intestine, through your stoma. But if there isn't any signs of active disease, then there are treatments like antidiarrheals, antispasmodics, which can help decrease the ostomy output and the cramping that can occur in the small intestine. And then occasionally we also will recommend what we call a lysis of adhesions if there is a lot of scar tissue, particularly if that has led to bowel obstructions. And unfortunately, that's a consequence that we see from Crohn's related surgeries, where although we're trying to treat the disease and get rid of diseased segments, anytime the surgeons have to go in there to do an operation, a consequence of that will be creating scar tissue in the abdomen, which can then lead to other complications down the road.
So things, Marlene should be seeing a gastroenterologist again for some of these newer treatments.
Yeah, I would say just make sure that there isn't any active disease that we're missing, and then look at those symptomatic treatments, which can help reduce the output coming from the stoma and reduce those cramps that she's been suffering from.
Marlene, good luck. Thank you for calling. Mary in La Crosse, we go to you. Hi, Mary.
This is really a good topic for me today. My son has had a problem with flatulence and burping for a lifetime and finally went to a gastroenterologist. They did a breath test and he breathed out methane and diagnosed this where he has an overgrowth of, I guess, good bacteria in his small intestine. There's an antibiotic they prescribed. It was horribly expensive. And I've done some Googling, of course, and do probiotics make a difference? Because I've seems like maybe and maybe not. But what would be the best treatment for this SIBO, they call it?
Yeah. Well, thanks for calling in with that question. So it sounds like your son's been diagnosed with small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or SIBO, like you said. And that's actually a condition where there's hyperproliferation of the gas-containing bacteria in the small intestine. And so the gold standard for treatment is antibiotics to help kind of recalibrate the bacterial composition and try to drive down those high concentrations of the gas-forming bacteria. My guess is your son was prescribed an antibiotic called rifaximin. The brand name is Xifaxan. It is somewhat of a designer antibiotic, and that's why, unfortunately, it is very expensive and sometimes very poorly covered by insurance. There are alternatives. So the Xifaxan or rifaximin is one of our newer antibiotics, but we've been treating SIBO for decades before that drug came to market. And so there are some other alternatives which are going to be cheaper, ciprofloxacin, metronidazole, erythromycin, tetracycline. So if there isn't a contraindication, let's say an allergy, he might be a candidate for one of those options, which should be cheaper and better covered by insurance. Your question, though, specifically was about probiotics. The data for probiotics and SIBO is less robust. Typically, what I do is in a patient with confirmed SIBO or with suspected SIBO, I'll try to use antibiotics first to kind of get those bacterial concentrations back to the, you know, the healthy levels that we want, and then use potentially a probiotic to support that. So the probiotic, I would say, is unlikely to kind of get him out of this bout of SIBO, but could be used down the road once the SIBO has been addressed to kind of prevent him from kind of getting back to where he was before.
Good points. Mary, thank you very much for calling. Lupe in Iola will go to you now. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I was recently diagnosed with acute diverticulitis. I'm 75 years old, and one of the medications they gave me was Cipro something or other, and now I've ripped a tendon in my ankle, which is one of the side effects. So I have two questions. One, how can I prevent getting this in the future? And secondly, how do I recognize the symptoms? Because I had no idea I had this for quite some time.
What do you think, Dr. Saha?
Oh, well, first, Lupe, I'm really sorry that you had that side effect on the ciprofloxacin. Like you said, it is one of the ones that we're aware can happen, but it's overall really rare. So I'm sorry you were, one of those patients who did get the tendon rupture. As far as prevention for future bouts of diverticulitis usually is the result of something kind of getting stuck in one of those pockets, one of those diverticula that we see form in the colon. Those pockets usually form because the colon has to kind of do more work to get things out. So to evacuate waste, the colon may have to squeeze more, and as a result, will form these outpouchings or diverticula. So constipation tends to be a problem in a lot of folks who have diverticulitis, and prevention of future bouts may hinge on keeping the bowels moving regularly, preventing kind of hard stool balls from collecting in those pockets, and just basically keeping the colon more flushed. So I would recommend a high fiber diet, avoiding and other measures to prevent constipation, like making sure that you're well hydrated, even using a daily laxative if needed. Something like Miralax is usually extremely well tolerated and will kind of help address mild to moderate constipation. For folks who have recurrent bouts of diverticulitis, where we will see sometimes the colon get narrowed and scarred as a result of it, sometimes surgery is the best option, because typically the diverticuli are all clustered into a specific part of the colon, and the surgeons can just do a resection of that portion. And you can live a very healthy, normal life without that portion of the colon. It's usually called a sigmoid colon resection. And that can be, in some ways, curative for future bouts if that's where all the diverticuli are located.
So that's some potential good news. Lupe, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Connie in Portage, your turn. Hi, Connie.
Good morning, Larry. My problem seems pretty simple after hearing all these other problems, but I have irritable bowel syndrome, and I have bloating and constipation, and I take Miralax, and sometimes I have to take that every day, at most of the time every day, but not, my daughter has it also, and I didn't realize this would be inherited, and I was wondering if there's anything that you can take besides. I hate that Miralax all the time.
Okay. Well, are there some other alternatives here, Dr. Saha?
Yeah. Well, Connie, I would say that, IBS isn't a simple disease, and there are lots of people who suffer from it, and so you're not alone. So if you are somebody who is what we call constipation predominant in their irritable bowel syndrome, the cornerstone of treatment is going to be something that keeps your colon moving, something like Miralax. Actually, you heard me respond to the other caller. It is one of our preferred laxatives in our field. Now, that being said, sometimes just increasing dietary fiber or using a fiber supplement, something as simple as psyllium husk or Metamucil or Citracel can be sufficient, and you don't need to rely on the daily laxative. Just increasing the fiber intake, whether it's through your diet or through a supplement, can do the can do the trick. Now, I will say, you mentioned that you have bloating, and for, you know, some of us are pretty low in our dietary fiber intake. Unfortunately, Americans are pretty dismal at getting their recommended dietary fiber in. So if you are somebody who doesn't normally incorporate a lot of fiber into their diet and is interested in doing so going forward, you should really do it gradually to avoid the bloating that can occur at the onset. So let's say you're, you know, going to explore using something like Metamucil, you'd start at like a teaspoon rather than the recommended tablespoon that you're going to see on the container, and then kind of work your way up. Otherwise, the gas and the bloating can be very limiting and make you want to stop it. On top of that, you mentioned like not wanting to take any medications. Well, I would also then say, yeah, I mean, look at your diet and then also think about increasing your physical activity. So increased physical activity, and it can be something as simple as walking, 3 to 5 days a week for 30 minutes. That increased cardiovascular activity can also, it gets our heart pumping, but it also gets our gut moving. And for somebody with chronic constipation, that can be very helpful as well.
And Connie mentioned her daughter having it too, and wondered if it's an inherited thing.
Well, so we don't actually think about IBS as being genetic, but I will say that children often follow the same dietary and lifestyle habits as their parents. So if the household is one where there wasn't a lot of, fresh fruits and vegetables incorporated into the diet, or potentially a lot of processed meats or other foods like that, then children may end up having the same conditions that their parents have. Likewise, exercise habits often, kids, live what they learn. And so, if they see their parents being very active, they tend to be very active, not always, but so I guess in that way, sometimes we'll see kids have the same conditions that their parents have, but it's not a genetic disease like we typically think of for something that's hereditary.
Dr. Simona Saha, our guest today, gastroenterologist at UW Health, professor in the Department of Medicine, our guest today. You can join in with your questions as we take a look at your digestive health with her. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert's our producer today, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at digestive health on the show today with our gastroenterologist, Dr. Simona Saha from the University of Wisconsin Department of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Join in with your questions. Chris in Milwaukee has one. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Oh, good morning. As an old-time listener, Larry, and on the boat trip in the lake, I say this, that I love to eat. And I have eaten healthily all my life. I eat lots of fruits and vegetables. I'm 93 years old. And now every time I eat, I get a stomach. And I have done the usual things, taking whatever that stuff is. But I would like, is there some underlying cause? I eat fruits and vegetables. I eat organic foods. I don't eat a lot of sweets. What can I do so that I can again enjoy eating?
Chris, it's good to hear your voice again. Dr. Saha, what do you think?
So, Chris, was this a fairly sudden change for you where you found that you were having pain after eating, or has it been more of a gradual issue?
Well, I just had a stomach ache after I eat.
Mm-hmm. And it's been going on for a while, Chris?
Yep. Yes.
And have you lost it?
I did have it. But before that, I had, oh my gosh, my heart stopped beating. I mean, it skipped a beat. but they put me in a tube and they fixed that. But they gave me wonderful food in the hospital, which I did pick and choose the vegetables and all. But truly, I have eaten well.
Well, I would. Have you lost any weight, Chris, since this started?
Well, it started so long ago. I did lose some weight at one time, but it was unrelated
to that.
You know, it was
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I would just say so. Inability to eat or pain with eating, it has a pretty broad what we call differential. So there are lots of different possibilities, some of which are, you know, fairly simple and benign, like maybe your stomach isn't emptying as quickly as it used to, something we call gastroparesis, and just eating smaller meals and, you know, taking, let's say, your breakfast and dividing that up into two or three little snacks that you spread out over, you know, maybe eating a little bit every hour can sometimes help move things through the stomach rather than just eating a large meal three times a day like we traditionally do. So, and that can occur with, you know, after a viral illness. It could occur as a result of maybe another medication that you're taking that slows down gastric emptying. Sometimes there can be inflammation in the stomach lining, which can cause pain after eating, something we call gastritis. But if this is something that's been going on for a long time, if there's been associated weight loss, I mean, those are what we do call red flags in medicine, and it could indicate something a little bit more serious. So I might recommend, you know, starting with your primary care doctor, but making sure that you've had laboratory studies to look at the pancreas, possibly an imaging study to look at the abdomen, and then maybe even an endoscopy, just so that we can, you know, kind of rule out the bad stuff. And if we don't see anything worrisome, then we go down this pathway of maybe treating for gastritis and changing your diet to help, you know, in case you have something like delayed gastric emptying or gastroparesis.
Chris, good luck, and thank you so much for calling. Please do follow up. Jeannie in Lake Geneva, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to know if the doctor had any experience analyzing stool using a company called Viome, V-I-O-M-E. I had a family history of GI problems, and I found that their genetic workup gave me a wonderful list of foods that would create an inflammatory response in me and foods that I should focus on. And it really, really changed my life.
Dr. Saha, are you familiar?
Well, I'm familiar, but I would say I'm not an expert. And I would also say that this area of research where we're doing, you know, microbiome analysis on the stool is still in its very early stages. So it is something where I think there's going to be a lot of promise going forward into the future. And it sounds like you've had a lot of good success with the knowledge that you've gained through your stool analysis. But I would say that it's not, you know, quote unquote, ready for prime time where we're using it routinely in the clinic, just because there's still a lot of unknown in terms of how do we manipulate the microbiome in a way that is going to promote health. So to answer your question, it's something I'm familiar with. I know that there are practitioners that are ordering these tests. We don't routinely do it at UW Health and in our gastroenterology department. We are not advocating use of these tests. They may not be well validated. They are not covered by insurance. And we don't have the exact kind of playbook of what to do when we see the abnormalities that might be reported. So there is other routine stool testing, which is really well validated. That's there are tests that we use to assess for inflammation. There are tests that we use to evaluate for specific pathogens in the stool. But the type of microbiome analysis that you're describing is still what I would consider to be somewhat experimental and not widely used in practice.
But it worked for you, GD, so that's a good thing. Thank you very much for calling. Carrie in Madison, your turn. Hi, Carrie.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to share my own experience. Probably about 15 years ago, well, maybe 20 years ago anyway, I was experiencing severe GERD and was put on medication for that, which did solve the problem, but I really didn't want to be on that medication for so long. I was on it for years and years. And at one point, my insurance changed their formulary and I got switched to a different medication. Suddenly started having really severe GI symptoms, bloating and diarrhea and all kinds of stuff. At the suggestion of a friend, I went on a gluten-free diet, completely gluten-free, including oats. Not only did the GERD completely disappear, within about 48 hours, my GI symptoms started to clear up rapidly. A number of other issues that I'd had for decades also started to clear up, including eczema and heel cracks and headaches and all kinds of things. After about 3 years on a gluten-free diet, I tried gluten-free oats, which I missed a lot, and immediately all of those symptoms came back and took about 3 months to get rid of. Anyway, I just wanted to share that with my own personal experience, and the amount of healing that I've had being gluten-free has been quite an eye-opener.
Carrie, thanks a lot for calling. Dr. Saha, comment.
Yeah, Carrie, I wonder if you underwent testing for celiac disease before you went gluten-free.
Well, in fact, I did, and those tests came back negative for celiac.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, we do know that there is a population of patients who are very gluten sensitive. They may not reach the kind of the diagnostic criteria that we set for celiac disease based on their labs and their tissue, the appearance of their small bowel under the microscope. But lots of patients, again, despite meeting that mark for the diagnostic criteria, will report kind of what you have, which is that they have a lot of symptoms, both the gastrointestinal and extra gastrointestinal, like the headaches and the eczema that you mentioned, which might clear up on a gluten-free diet. So I think that, you know, I'm really glad that you found something that has worked so remarkably well for you. We do sometimes recommend a gluten-free diet even for non-celiacs, but I will say that we don't recommend it for everybody. So, you know, there is a certain amount of kind of bad dieting out there where people kind of go gluten-free or dairy-free or other, you know, exclude other things from their diet. And we just don't want to see people eliminating too many groups of food, because sometimes this will lead to eating disorders, malnutrition, and just like a fear of food, which can have really negative consequences for somebody from a psychosocial and emotional standpoint. So in your case, Carrie, I mean, again, I think you did the detective work and you figured out for you what the trigger was. And there are other people who I think are like you, but as in general, we're a little bit reluctant to recommend too many elimination diets for fear that can lead to other negative consequences.
Carrie, good for you, and thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Tim and Ladysmith next. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So a couple of questions I have. I've been an IBS sufferer for 30-plus years, negative celiac. I've tried numerous diets, including gluten-free, for over 11 years. So the question I have with the good doctor is threefold. One, especially with somebody who's IBS constipation dominant, is there a benefit for soluble fiber versus insoluble fiber? And the reason I say that is because some people that have constipation, when they finally evacuate their bowels, the first evacuation portion is very dried out. So sometimes my experience has been with insoluble fiber that I can't keep the colon wet enough. What has been helping is a stool softener called Bisacodyl, which will draw water through that luminal wall into the colon. The second thing I was wondering is that where are we at with microbiome research? I know they've been doing it at Mayo in Michigan for irritable bowel disease, but I don't know so much if they're looking at it for syndrome. especially its interaction with the vagus nerve, and if fecal transplant is better, because a lot of people who take probiotics can't get past that hydrochloric acid of the stomach. And then the last portion of my question was to ask, is there been any look at with people with IBS constipation at the IC or ileocecal valve competency, meaning is it opening and closing as it should? And I'll take my answers offline. Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Got a lot there.
Those are great questions, Tim. And I mean, I think a lot of what you are talking about is kind of like, you know, IBS 2.0. Where do we go from here? And kind of what is the research pointing us to in terms of how we're going to treat this disease for the next, you know, 20 to 25 years. I mean, you started by talking about fiber and insoluble versus soluble. I will say fiber remains like the kind of the cornerstone for treatment of IBS, both the diarrhea predominant form, the constipation predominant form, and the mixed form. I tell patients that fiber is kind of like a magic, you know, it's a magic bullet for the colon. It can really recalibrate stool consistency and stool form. And you mentioned that certain forms of fiber kind of dries out the stool. I will say that fiber works best when you're well hydrated. And I assume, Tim, as somebody who's had IBS for many years, you probably already know that and are very well hydrated. But for people who are new to experimenting with fiber, as I had mentioned to a previous caller, start slow. Don't kind of go straight up to the recommended dosing because it can lead to a lot of gas and bloating. And just make sure that you are staying, that you are getting the adequate amount of hydration, whether that's in the form of water or other, you know, kind of sports drinks that don't contain a lot of sugar. And then as far as, you know, your question about the microbiome, you're right. There's probably more research being done in the role of the microbiome in inflammatory bowel disease. So that's Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. But there may be also a component of dysbiosis or altered gut bacteria in IBS as well. And I suspect that we will learn a lot from what comes from the IBD research that we can then translate and apply to our IBS patients. So I guess stay tuned. I'm hoping that within, you know, my, you know, length of my career, I'm going to see some microbiome-based therapies, not only for inflammatory bowel disease, but also for IBS. And then your last question, I think, had to do with vagal nerve stimulation and how the autonomic nervous system may impact IBS. So there is a very interesting new device that was approved in pediatrics called IBSTIM. So that's approved for kids with irritable bowel syndrome, 18 and under, which is basically manipulating the autonomic nervous system to reduce the pain that is associated with IBS. So kids wear like a little device around their ear. It stimulates the auricular nerve, which is part of the autonomic nervous system. And we have seen some really good success in terms of mitigating abdominal pain with that. Now, it's not approved yet in adults because the trials haven't been done. But I think that, you know, like I think you're right on the money in terms of potential therapies that are going to target the vagus nerve at some point being available for a broader swath of patients with IBS.
Tim, thanks very much for those questions. And Bradley in Whitewater will give you a chance. Hi, Bradley.
Yes, hello. I was listening to a doctor on social media that talked about drinking any liquid, even water, while you eat your meal or beforehand or even an hour afterward. And I just want...
Oh, you're breaking up, Bradley. I'm sorry. Is drinking water with a meal a good idea? I think is his main question.
You know, I think, you know, so for our patients who suffer from gastroparesis or, you know, Larry, you mentioned I take care of a lot of women with pregnancy disorders that relate to the GI tract. So nausea and vomiting of pregnancy and hyperemesis. Now, in those populations, we actually recommend separating solids from liquids and not putting all of that in at the same time. And so drinking your beverage apart from your solid meal, that actually helps gastric emptying. But I think for the average person who has a pretty normal functioning GI tract, we know that in general, people are pretty poorly hydrated. You know, we don't think about drinking enough in between our meals, that I think that drinking with your meal is absolutely fine. And especially if that's the only way that you're going to get your hydration in.
Bradley, there you go. Thank you so much. James emailed us. They've had ulcerative colitis since they were 16, in their mid-40s now, managed it with mesalamine for many years. As they're getting older, they see more flare-ups, though. Mm-hmm. The GI wants them to go on biologicals, but they already have a good immune system, a bad immune system, and, what should they do?
Yeah, this is I know, there's a lot, sometimes it's a bitter pill to swallow when you're being advised to take start a biologic, because, like the caller mentioned, patients with inflammatory bowel disease have a dysregulated immune system, and now we're recommending taking an immunosuppressant. What I will say is that the immunosuppressants that we use for inflammatory bowel disease are overall well tolerated, and for people who are otherwise young and healthy, meaning don't have a lot of comorbidities like history of cancer, high blood pressure, diabetes, the infection risk is overall, reasonable and manageable, and we don't see a lot of serious infections. Now, you could say, well, I don't want a not serious infection. I don't want to get a sore throat, and I don't want to get every cold that my kid brings home from school. So what I usually recommend when we're starting a biologic, I say that, yes, you might see a higher risk of infections. The likelihood that these are going to be serious infections and land you in the hospital are quite low, but we're obviously going to monitor. If you have a lot of kind of what I would call like nuisance infections where you don't feel well, maybe you've got to go on antibiotics intermittently, we'll monitor that and see, are the benefits of the medication from a UC perspective enough to warrant staying on the medicine, or are those side effects so limiting that we just have to stop the drug? I mean, if somebody is at the point where they need to start a biologic, that likely means that they have really severe disease that is leading to frequent steroid use, might be causing anemia, and putting the person at increased risk for colon cancer. So those risks need to be balanced against the risk of infection. And for most patients, assuming that, again, somebody has gotten to the point where they really warrant the medication, the benefits of the medication outweigh the risks.
So what's the most important thing people can do to keep their digestive systems healthy?
Well, I think it comes down to the basics. I mean, eating good food, right? So eating whole foods, fresh vegetables, limiting intake of high-fat foods, highly processed meats, a diet that's high in fiber, regular exercise. And that's I think good advice, not only for the gut, but for our overall health. I'm going to put a plug in, because we haven't talked about it yet, Larry, about colon cancer screening. So for all of our listeners out there who are 45 years of age or up, please check with your healthcare provider to see if you are up to date on your colon cancer screening. Somewhere during the pandemic, our GI societies and the American Cancer Society lowered the screening age from 50 to 45. And a lot of our listeners may have missed their primary care appointments during that time and may not have heard that messaging. So really, I want to make a plug for colon cancer screening, since 6 out of 10 colon cancer deaths are preventable with screening. So on top of those lifestyle things, get screened for colon cancer.
I've got my screen coming up in January.
Good job.
My latest one.
I actually just got mine done this year, too. So,
it's a great pleasure to talk with you today, Dr. Sahai. I hope we can do this again. Obviously, a lot of interest in it. So please come back and be with us again.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Simona Saha is a gastroenterologist at UW Health, professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Great to have her with us, and we'll get her back. We'll do it again. Obviously, a lot of interest in this area. Well, coming up, we are going to take a look at COVID shots. There have been some approvals now from the FDA, and we'll learn about that and a whole lot more with our next guest, Ajay Sethi. That's next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.